Yeah, the point of this intro is really to convince people to be pretty suspicious of the new fad for pushing zero emissions by 2050 or whenever as a way to solve the climate crisis. So to that end, I'll just start with this slide. And yeah, I guess I could probably just leave it there. What do you reckon? Pretty convincing evidence. Anyway, I won't leave it there because I do have to provide some more evidence, even though you might want to just agree with me based on the basis that Murdoch is now advocating for net zero. So I don't know, probably people have sort of heard a bit about the latest IPCC report, and it really made it clear that if we don't do something quickly about global emissions, then we're headed for disaster. Even if emissions start going down now, to get to zero by 2050, even if we do that, we're still going to break through the 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming that many scientists think is the safe limit of warming. And it's much more likely that we'll eventually go beyond 2 degrees and possibly much higher. And to get a understanding of what that means, you really only have to look at what's happened over the summer in the Northern Hemisphere. July was the world's hottest month on record, and the higher than average temperatures brought with them a litany of disasters, not only extreme droughts, heat waves and fires, but also devastating floods. And I don't have time to go through it all, so you probably hopefully get a bit of a gist from the slide. And no matter what we do from here, over the next 3 decades at least, this is going to keep getting worse. And if we fail to rapidly reduce emissions to zero, the second half of this century is going to be worse again, with many millions likely to be displaced by rising seas and parts of the world becoming too hot for human habitation. And, you know, I won't go through all the kind of carnage that's going to unfold. It should be pretty familiar with people. And in this context, many people have actually like welcomed governments and corporations pledging to achieve net zero by 2050, or in China's case, 2060. And the Australian government has been heavily criticised for not joining the net zero club. These promises are seen by many people as a sign that global leaders are finally waking up to the need for drastic action. For decades, many politicians and big corporations, they just, you know, denied the reality of climate change and explicitly argued against the need to do anything much about it. But as the evidence has mounted, scientific evidence, and more people have been convinced that they need to do something, it's not really politically tenable for them just to deny climate change anymore. So now politicians and corporations have to seem like they're doing something. And that's where net zero targets come in. Pledging to achieve net zero emissions is the almost universally accepted, unfortunately, way these days of proving your commitment to doing something about climate change. So yeah, in September last year, the UN celebrated a doubling of the number of commitments to reach net zero emissions from local governments and business. And the press release, you see a bit of it here, congratulated everyone from Ford to Facebook to the state of New South Wales. Unfortunately, though, when you scratch the surface, you see all these net zero targets aren't really as green as they're made out to be. And there's a number of reasons for this that I'll go through. The main thing, I think, is that they all rely heavily on offsetting. Committing to net zero emissions doesn't mean cutting emissions to zero. It doesn't actually have to mean cutting emissions at all. It just means committing to cancelling out whatever emissions are produced with things like carbon capture and storage, tree planting, and so on. And you might say, on one level, what's wrong with that? As long as the outcome's the same, net zero emissions, it doesn't matter if it's achieved by massively decreasing the amount of greenhouse gas emissions going into the atmosphere or massively increasing the amount that's being sucked out in various ways. So it sort of seems like, you know, what's the problem? The problem, in essence, is that while we're very good, well, not us, but corporations and governments are very good at pumping ever larger quantities of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, when it comes to sucking it out again, it gets a bit vague. And when you look at companies and governments' plans in a bit more detail, you see that the bold claims about offsetting don't really match the reality at all. And there are a few different methods of offsetting that get talked about most frequently. And so I'm going to go through now and look at the main ones and see how they stack up. First off, it's carbon capture and storage, or CCS for short. This is probably the most common thing pointed to as this kind of magical technological solution to the climate crisis. So if you do a Google image search for carbon capture and storage, you'll come up with a bunch of illustrations like this, you know, pages and pages of them. And it, you know, makes it look all quite straightforward. But it turns out, unsurprisingly, that it's much simpler to make a diagram illustrating how CCS will work than to make it actually work. This is a list of the biggest operational CCS projects globally as of last year. If you add up the total capacity of all the operational CCS projects in the world today, you get to around 39 million tons a year. That might sound like a lot, but let's compare it now to total global carbon emissions at their pre-pandemic peak in 2019. So hopefully people can see that. Well, you probably can't see the column that's representative of the carbon capture and storage. It's not very impressive, to say the least. You might say barely existent. Of course, though, CCS enthusiasts would probably respond that it's all about to take off, so that the capture column is going to rocket up and meet the emissions column on the way down. That might be convincing if it wasn't for the fact that CCS has already been around for quite a long time now. If it was just starting, if it was like the last 2 years, you know, look, we already got to 39 million tons a year. But actually, they've been spruiking it for decades now, and that's taken all that time to get to that pathetic little bit down the bottom there. And it's not exactly going up in leaps and bounds. And when you look at it on a more granular level, I'll do now, you see why. So take Australia's biggest CCS project to date, which is attached to Chevron's Gorgon gas field in Western Australia, which I believe is like one of the biggest gas operations in the world. So when Chevron, in partnership with Shell and ExxonMobil, got the green light to start the project in 2009, they signed a contract promising that alongside the gas plant, they'd build infrastructure required to inject at least 80% of the carbon dioxide released from the gas reservoir back into the ground. And this is partly, you know, the Western Australian government has been criticised for letting them build this in that, basically in a nature reserve, this giant gas plant. So it's sort of a trade-off. And they actually spent $2 billion setting this CCS operation up. But despite the project being in operation for almost 6 years now, they've never actually been able to get the whole thing working properly. And this is, there's been a litany of problems. One of the main ones is just that the pump that they've been using to drain water from the underground aquifer into which they want to inject the carbon just keeps filling up with sand. And this is, it's a bit of a complicated graph, but what it shows is the emissions from Gorgon since it started pumping gas in 2016, and the total emissions amount to around 37 million tons, and the total successfully captured and stored is less than 5 million. So, yeah, not very impressive. And the dotted line is what they were supposed to do. And yeah, there's some talk that the government's going to fine them, but I won't be holding my breath in a state like Western Australia that they're actually going to fine a fossil fuel company. So another project that's got a bunch of media fanfare recently is one in Iceland, which is pitched as the world's biggest machine for capturing carbon directly from the air and storing it as rock. And there's a picture of that machine. So this is basically just like the ultimate technological fantasy for people who want to believe that we can solve climate change without actually ditching fossil fuels. So you just, you know, in theory, set up a bunch of these giant fans and you'd suck carbon straight out of the atmosphere and we'll get to net zero in no time at all. Unfortunately, though, it's not quite as impressive as the headlines might have suggested. Once fully operational, this machine will suck just 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere per year. And that's equivalent to the emissions from only 870 cars. So I did a quick kind of back of the envelope calculation and worked out that you'd have to build 9 million of these machines to cancel out the pre-pandemic global carbon emissions. And that would cost something in the order of US$100 trillion. And that doesn't actually include all the extra energy infrastructure you'd have to build to power them, and probably then all the additional machines that you'd have to do to offset the carbon emissions from all that energy infrastructure. And by comparison, a 2019 report by researchers at Stanford University found that it would only cost US$73 trillion for the entire world to transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050. Okay, so the thing about machines for capturing carbon directly from the air is that those kind of machines already exist, and they're much, much cheaper than the one in Iceland, and they're called trees. And that's a pretty accurate scientific diagram of how they work. So trees provide, on the surface of it, a much better way to offset emissions than spending millions, or in the case of Chevron's Gorgon gas plant, billions on expensive carbon capture and storage facilities. And it actually is, because of this, a rapidly growing area of interest for business and for governments keen to prove their green credentials. And you might say, again, like, that surely there can't be anything wrong with this. Because, you know, what could possibly be wrong with planting trees? Unfortunately, though, there are significant problems. For a start, in most cases, the offsetting done with trees to date doesn't actually involve planting trees. It just involves stopping them from being cut down. So we're not talking about something that will actually boost the amount of CO2 that's being sucked out of the atmosphere, but only something that will theoretically ensure that more CO2 is being sucked out than would occur under a business as usual scenario. And the business as usual scenario involves around 10 million hectares of the world's forests being logged every year, which equates to an area the size of Portugal every decade. And around half of that is offset by regrowth forests, meaning a net loss of 5 million hectares a year. And the most common kinds of offsetting projects to date that involve trees are centered just on the rate of slowing down the rate of deforestation. Airlines, banks, and so on pay someone, in effect, to protect an area of forest from logging. And the quantity of the offset is calculated using models that predict how much of the forest would have been logged in the absence of the offsetting scheme. And this, incidentally, is also the method the Australian government has relied on for its dubious claims of progress on emissions reductions. The Minister for Energy and Emissions Reductions, Angus Taylor, recently boasted that Australia's greenhouse gas emissions are 20.8% below 2005 levels. What he doesn't say, though, is that in 2005, there was a spike in land clearing in Australia, which is represented by the light green bit at the top of the graph. It reached its highest level since early 1990s. And since then, the rate of deforestation has been slower. And in recent years, apparently, because this is also very much rotted, there's been a net gain in forested land. And this is the basis for almost the entire amount of emissions reductions that the Australian government has claimed. If, like basically every other country in the world, we excluded this from our emissions profile, then our emissions wouldn't have had any decline at all. And this kind of sleight of hand is used in offsetting schemes everywhere. The Guardian newspaper recently teamed up with Greenpeace to do an in-depth investigation of the schemes used by major airlines. And they found that, just as with Australia, a lot of these schemes boosted their claimed emissions reductions by exaggerating the amount of deforestation that would have occurred if the schemes didn't exist. So just like the Australian government, they pick a year of particularly high deforestation and then use that as the baseline on which they develop their models. The other problem with trees as a means of offsetting emissions is that there are some pretty serious constraints actually on how many of them can be planted without it starting to eat into areas required to produce the food that people need to eat. In some parts of the world, valuable farmland is already being eaten up by more lucrative offsetting plantations, in addition to crops grown for supposedly green biofuels. And when you look at how much companies and governments themselves say they're going to do in this area, the scale of the problem becomes clear. A recent report by Oxfam put it like this: it's mathematically impossible to plant enough trees to meet the combined net zero targets announced by governments and corporations, as there's simply not enough land to do this. The report found that the total area of land that would be needed to meet existing plans for carbon removal could be up to 5 times the size of India and equivalent to all of the farmland on the planet today. And the report looked in detail at the implications for land use of the policies of the 4 biggest fossil fuel companies to have made net zero pledges to date, which is Shell, BP, Total Energies, and Eni. And it found that based on these companies' existing commitments, they would require an area of land equivalent to that of the UK by 2030. And as this slide indicates, by 2050, they'd need between 50 and 70 million hectares, which is double the size of the UK. And when you extend this to the rest of the world's governments and corporations, you start to see how ridiculous it all becomes. Now, there's another related method of offsetting that's got some attention recently, in part thanks to our own Scott Morrison, and that's so-called blue carbon, which Morrison spruiked as a fancy new alternative to tree planting at Joe Biden's climate summit earlier this year. Blue carbon is just carbon that's stored in plants, seagrasses, mangroves, kelp forests, and so on in the oceans. And the same principle obviously applies here as applies to forests. The more of these sea plants you protect, the more you grow, the more carbon is stored that would otherwise end up in the atmosphere. And in fact, these ocean forests can absorb carbon much more rapidly than forests on the land, which is partly why they're so excited about blue carbon as the great new thing. The same problems apply though. The total amount of carbon dioxide stored in this way is only a tiny fraction of global emissions. And currently, these kind of ocean ecosystems are actually being destroyed at a rapid pace. So in Tasmania, for example, rising water temperature and acidification has killed 95% of kelp forests in the past 80 years. And protecting a few areas of mangroves here and there, and that's kind of all the Australian government really is talking about with blue carbon, or even planting like wide areas of kelp forests, is not really going to put much of a dent in this process. So I think blue carbon is just basically another meaningless buzzword in the arsenal of those who are seeking to greenwash capitalist business as usual. Okay, so the last fancy new method for sucking carbon out of the atmosphere that I'll talk about is bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, or BECCS for short. And there's a nice diagram of theoretically how BECCS would work. And really, like, at this point, you just start to think they're actually just taking the piss. BECCS supposedly can work because it involves planting a forest which sucks carbon out of the atmosphere as it grows. Then you cut the forest down and burn it in a power station to produce electricity. And then you capture the carbon emissions from that and inject them underground, and then you replant the forest and start the whole thing again. And so basically this just kind of brings together all the main other, the failures of all the main other methods of offsetting into one big melange. And there are currently very few operating examples of BECCS in the world. In 2019, there were 5 facilities operating, collectively capturing a total of 1.5 million tonnes of CO2. And I won't do a graph comparing that to the world's total emissions because you won't be able to see the line at all. And given all the problems with carbon capture and storage I've discussed, I just think there's no reason to think that BECCS is going to really ramp up massively anytime soon. All right. So given all the problems with the various methods of offsetting carbon emissions that I've outlined, those promising net zero emissions aren't relying on them all that much, right? Surely they're looking to sharply cut emissions at the same time. Unfortunately, the answer is no. Major fossil fuel companies like Shell, for example, that have promised to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 are proposing to do this almost entirely through offsetting. They're not actually proposing any cut in their production of fossil fuels at all. So in Shell's case, for example, they project that by 2030, they'll be offsetting more emissions than were offset by the entire world in 2019. And this graph shows the broader picture. The orange line at the top tracks the amount of fossil fuel production that's being planned by the world's governments over the coming decades. And it compares it to the line at the bottom, which shows the trajectory if we're to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. So as you can see from this, they're not planning to cut production at all. In fact, they're planning to increase production globally. And so offsetting is being made to do a lot, in fact, all of the work in terms of getting to net zero. Okay, so another problem with net zero targets is that they're almost all set far enough in the future to mean that nothing much actually has to happen now. Given how old most of our political leaders and corporate executives are, it's doubtful they're going to care much about what's happening in the world in 2050. By then, a lot of them are going to be dead, and if they're not, they'll be in comfortable, well-funded retirements. US President Joe Biden provides a particularly clear example of this, I think. Many environmentalists welcomed his election as like supposedly some big turning point. In his campaign, he promised to make US power generation completely carbon-free by 2035 and to achieve net zero emissions across the entire economy by 2050. To date, however, he hasn't made any firm commitments at all about what kind of emissions reductions will occur in the next 4 to 8 years of his presidency. And all the signs so far suggest that he's going to continue to support the oil and gas boom that began under Barack Obama. In fact, despite all the green rhetoric, Biden's administration has provided over a record-breaking pace of approvals of new oil and gas wells on public land. And these approvals are, in effect, locking in high levels of production and hence emissions for years to come, by which point Biden himself will definitely no longer be around to take responsibility for it. And it's hardly necessary to say that Australia is no better. I think it's possible even the coalition will decide to promise net zero by 2050 at some point. The Murdoch thing is kind of a sign of where things are going. They're not stupid. They can see from the US and elsewhere kind of that you gain political capital from doing that, but that it actually doesn't cost really anything at all in terms of actually doing much to curb emissions in the short term. And meanwhile, Australia's fossil fuel industry is booming. You might have got the impression that at least maybe some progress is being made, but the reality, I think, is even worse than most people imagine. So here's Australia's energy production by fuel type. And that tiny little sliver up the top that's hardly grown in proportion in the last 40 years is renewables. And this is coal and gas production, which are both at or near record highs. And with the proposed gas-led recovery now underway and the massive coal resources of the Galilee Basin being opened up, we can expect these figures to go even higher in the years ahead. So to start to conclude, I don't think we should accept that these net zero targets are really going to get us anywhere near where we need to be. I think they should be seen, as the title of this talk suggests, as being the latest trend in corporate and government greenwashing. They can't deny the reality of climate change anymore and have to be seen to be doing something about it. And setting long-term net zero targets creates the appearance of action without any of its substance. So to finish, I want to say a few things about what should be happening now and what we can do to push in that direction. First off, we should recognise that, as the IPCC put it in their 2018 report, achieving the emissions cuts we require needs rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. And that's become, for me, a kind of handy yardstick for judging whether or not we're actually headed in the right direction. Are we seeing rapid and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society? The answer is clearly no. To the extent that any change can be said to be happening at all, it's very marginal. A lot has been made in recent times of increases in investment in renewable energy. Globally, it has been going up fast, but it's coming from a very low base. And you have to factor in that use of fossil fuels has also been growing rapidly. As of 2020, 84.3% of global energy came from fossil fuels. That's just 1.8% less than it was in 2000. And during that time, total energy consumption has grown massively. So here's what it looks like in the long-term view. And you can see that to turn this situation around, it's going to take a lot more than just a bit of growth, even if rapid, in investment in renewables. To really be moving in the right direction, we should be seeing massive government investment in renewables on a scale that would be possible to miss. There'd be billions being spent in every country in the world and millions of workers recruited to construct and operate everything. Governments would be forcing fossil fuel companies to shut down their operations rather than, as is the case today, continuing to give them massive subsidies. And the changes would go well beyond just the energy system. We should be seeing big investment in improved public transport networks, including fast rail to connect our cities and reduce the need for air travel. We should be seeing transformation of our cities to make it easier to get around without relying on cars. We should be seeing buildings being renovated to increase energy efficiency. We should be seeing reforestation, not just in plantations in rural areas, but everywhere, including in cities. And of course, I could go on like this for a lot longer with all the things that should be happening. What we see today isn't anything like this. It's just the fossil fuel driven business as usual, with a bit of green decoration dangled in front of our eyes by business leaders, politicians, and the media. They recognize climate change is happening, but they're preparing to live with it, just like they want us to live with COVID-19. So what we need to do, first of all, is stop believing that the leaders of global capitalism today are going to save us. If we're to avert the climate catastrophe they're driving us into, we need to make the changes ourselves. And I don't mean kind of be the change you want to see or any of that crap. I mean actually building a movement centered on the power of workers at the point of production that can actually wrest control of the economy and society away from the capitalist ruling class. In the short term, this means fostering every little flicker of resistance, whether it's a mass protest in the streets or actions by smaller groups of activists to disrupt the normal functioning of the fossil fuel economy. Ultimately, though, it means revolution. It means a democratically planned and collectively organized economy in which all those things that I mentioned before can be done, things that aren't done under capitalism because they conflict with the drive to profit, but which in a rational society would be done immediately just because they make sense from any human perspective. It means, in other words, socialism, which coincidentally is a major theme of this conference. And I'll leave it there. Thanks, everyone.